Oath of Election. And we're going to accommodate our friend and colleague from the House and open a public hearing on House Bill 2717. Representative Wilson.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Starr and member of the committee. It's a pleasure to be before you today, talking about a subject that is near and dear to my heart, and that is radio broadcasting. I wasn't born in a radio station, and I don't want to say any more than that. My mother may chase me down this afternoon and beat me about the head and face if I say where I probably really got my start. I suspect it was in a radio station. But I want to talk about the subject at hand today, and that is radio broadcasting as it relates to political advertising. I have, as I mentioned, been in the business for many years. My father was announcer salesman, as he followed his profession, and luckily became the owner of a radio station that became two some years later. So I have spent my entire working life inside radio stations, seeing how they operate, and starting out at the low end of the totem pole and moving up as time went on. And one of the interesting things that we've had to deal with in our business over the years has been political advertising. Back in the old days, back in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't all that contentious. But political advertising and political races being what they are, in the recent years, and I'll go back perhaps 15 years, we have engaged in the conversation repeatedly over the last 15 years. Maybe we should sit this election out, and maybe we should forget about running any political advertising because it is becoming more problem than it's worth. I think most of us realize that radio stations, broadcast media, have to sell advertisements to candidates at the low-end rate. In other words, we have to offer to political candidates the rate that our most creditworthy and frequency-discounted corporate customers get. So we really don't make all that much money on political advertising. What it does on our radio stations is it tends to congest our programming to the point to where our listeners begin to complain about it. In my case, over the years, we have charged as little as $7 for a 30-second radio advertisement, which is not very much. But that is the rate that we've had to extend to political broadcasters. Now, issues, ballot measures, we don't have to charge that rate to. We can charge our market rates. But when it comes to the politicians, we have to offer the low-end rate. So we're offering something that our customers are complaining about because of the frequency, first of all, because we're offering them at such a low unit price. Politicians can buy many, many of them, and quite often we're just having to try to hold them back. We're saying we're sold out. We can't sell any more of these things. Our listeners are complaining because they, in many cases, don't like political advertising. They don't like the frequency that we're selling it. And then we have to deal with the complaints from the public about the content of political advertising. In our local elections, it gets especially bad sometimes because some of these elections may be recall elections or dealing with specific social issues locally that that draw a tremendous amount of contention. But we've seen a number of statewide issues draw that kind of heat and that kind of fire over the last couple of years. So I'm not entirely sure that we as radio broadcasters want to really continue our participation in political advertising and the selling of same, because it is getting so contentious that we risk making our regular listeners angry at us for the frequency and the content, but yet something that is even more fearsome than all of that to us, and that is the threat of political lawsuit over ads that someone doesn't like. And we've had people not even associated with the candidacies of these particular candidates call and threaten to sue us over something that is said. I do want to tell you that we take great care as political advertisers actively involved in our community and lifelong residents there to be extremely careful about the political advertising that we allow on our station. We can oftentimes smell a rat, and we will talk to the people who are trying to run these commercials, and we tell them, we're really uncomfortable with this, and we want you to rethink your position on this. But in many cases, these ads don't come from local candidates. They'll come from statewide candidates. And typically speaking, these commercials come to us on a reel-to-reel or sometimes a cassette, but most of the time a reel-to-reel tape. Many times, due to the nature of political advertising and the ability of radio especially to turn on a dime, we receive these ads late. The order, the commercial order, has already commenced. We were supposed to be running these ads yesterday, and suddenly, at the last minute, we get a reel-to-reel tape, and it's a tape for candidate X, and one of our young people will receive this tape, run it into the studio, either put it directly into the computer or cartridge tape, and suddenly they're on the air, because we're running late. Through no fault of our own, we've received the continuity behind schedule. And so we'll have our production director or our person working in the production room at that moment hustle really quickly, get that thing done, get it on the air. And so through no fault of our own and trying to meet the requirements of the contract, we'll get a commercial on before we have a chance to listen to it very closely, especially if it's a statewide order that's come out of a regional agency. And so we can conceivably run an ad once or twice without management hearing it. Hopefully management gets a chance to hear these things, but sometimes we don't have the opportunity to do that before the ads actually run. So it's not uncommon to receive telephone calls from members at large in the public saying, if you run that thing one more time, I'm going to sue you. And we'll listen to the ad, and many times it'll be innocuous, but the person just doesn't like what was said. Not particularly inflammatory, but that's beside the point in politics in many cases. So that is the situation we find ourselves in. And as I say, it all goes back to one aspect, and that is we very much want to participate in our community. We take great pride as media outlets in being an information source to the voters in our community. But there will come a time, and again, we've discussed this repeatedly over the last years, whether we should even go there. But first of all, we don't make that much money. We have to sell these ads to the politicians. Many times we have to preempt our regular commercial advertisers to get political advertising on the air. And I do expect that if conditions go the way that they have been developing in the last years, that my father and brother and I will sit down one day before an election season and say, it's no longer worth the risk, it's no longer worth the disgust and revulsion that some of our listeners have at political advertising, and maybe we should just sit this one out. So that said, I'd be happy to answer any questions based on a lifetime inside radio stations.
The issue at hand in the bill 2717 is liability, and you're saying that if we remove the liability, that makes it easier for you to continue to run the political ads.
That is correct, and I do want to put a caveat on that. It's not like we say, okay, we're going to run this and don't touch us. We remain very, very careful about the content of these ads anyway, and especially as they relate to candidates we know in our own locality. We want to make sure that no one is impugned, and we try to be very, very careful with this, and so this is not something that we would take advantage of, but we would like to be held immune from liability on these things. We would like to have this not figure into the equation as to whether we're going to continue to run political advertising or not.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller.
Are there others that perform this service, furthering these publications or statements, like newspapers, that should be entitled to the same exemption?
Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, it's been our experience over the years that the print media has not had to face the kind of things that the electronic media has over time. I expect the same threat of lawsuit probably exists with the print media. The print media does not have to sell, to my knowledge, to politicians at any form of a discount whatsoever. And a newspaper can just add another couple of pages anytime they have too many ads. But we, of course, deal with a finite thing, which is the clock itself. And we can't run all commercials all the time. We can't add another page, as it were.
In the scene you said the tape comes in and it goes back to the young person who apparently doesn't have the requisite amount of time to determine the content, whether it's true or false. Could you not insulate yourself somewhat by just taking the appropriate time and trying to determine to the best of your ability whether or not the content is true or false, and just telling the person who wants that message on the air that we're going to get it on, but we need to protect ourselves and we need to review the content?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, it's conceivable that that could happen. My experience in radio shows me that that can happen, but it's likely to not happen in certain instances. I'm thinking a lot of this tends to be a judgment call, and age and wisdom and experience in the business aids those of us in management to know when you've got a problem. But in many cases, your individuals who receive these tapes are young, and they don't have the alarm bells go off like we do. And there's always the pressure to try to get those commercials on according to the contract. That's something that we're bound to do. And if we fail to get those ads on when the contract states, it triggers another unpleasant mechanism within our business where we have to do make goods, and in many cases we have to go into the computer and painstakingly rearrange the quote-unquote dates and times that many political advertisers and commercial advertisers want. And that becomes a bookkeeping nightmare. So there's always pressure to try to meet the terms of the contract.
I would assume,
other question.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If someone provided you with this false publication, that the person who was offended by this publication, in the event you were exempt, would still have a cause of action against the other person who actually produced the spot, would they not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I would think so, and that's what I would expect. That's what I would hope for.
One other question, if I might, Mr. Chairman. That is, in this case, what would you likely do if you had your discussion with the family and you decided, okay, one more time, we'll put up with this stuff, and you're exempt, so the bill passes. And you do receive them in advertising that is, in your view, not correct, not factually correct. What do you do in that circumstance, knowing you are exempt? At what point do you become the judge and jury and say, no, we're not playing this? What leeway do you have in that situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, if that situation were to happen in our business and we knew we were exempt, yet we received continuity from a local candidate or even a statewide candidate, we would approach it really in two distinct ways. If it were a local candidate, we would go ahead knowing that we're exempt from this, in that we're members of our community and we love to be a good fit as we have always been. We would approach the offending candidate and speak to them directly about that. In many cases we would tell them, if it goes over the line, we're not going to run the ad because we know it to be false. If it's in poor taste, we have leaned on candidates before. There have been some social issues that yielded ads that were in extremely poor taste, and we did tell the advertiser at that point that we would not run those ads. And so we would, if it were a local candidate, we would exert that kind of pressure on them. If it were a statewide candidate for office, and we absolutely felt that we knew incontrovertibly that the ad was wrong, we would not play it. If we felt that it happened to be in poor taste, or we thought it might be wrong, we would call the advertising agency that produced the commercial.
Any further questions? Senator Bryan.
If there is something that is transmitted that turns out to be false and libelous, it's my understanding also that your station could be in trouble with federal licensing people if, in fact, you knew or should have known that the statement was false. And I'm basing this on something that happened in Fifth Oregon years ago when I represented a radio station and had some brief comments and exchanged a letter with someone from the federal agency that licensed radio stations. Mm-hmm. Is that still a practice?
Chair Starr and Senator Bryant, I am not, given the state of radio and some of the things that you hear on radio anymore, I'm not extremely aware of what the FCC is concerned with anymore. But when it comes to a threat to us from the FCC about the continuity of political advertising, can't make a definite statement on that. I do know that we are not liable for a federal commercial. But when it comes to a state race or a local race, we personally are civilly liable. I know that. But I'm not sure at this stage of the game. I feel like it's been an eternity since I've been in the radio business here in the last 4 months. But I'd have to go back and refresh my memory as to whether the FCC cares about that particular issue.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. By the way, I hope the Senate will cooperate with the House in getting me back into the radio business as soon as possible.
And the legal one.
Yeah, me too. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and call a couple more witnesses here. Question you that we are under some time constraints, so if you, Mike Dewey, where'd Mike go? Mike ran away.
He was here.
Mike Dewey.
Mike, go ahead. Headed to Mike.
Please,
Chairman. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Egan. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. And with me is Don Monahan, legal counsel to the Broadcasters Association. Representative Wilson did a good job, I think, introducing the basic concept of the bill. I have written testimony here that I will drop with committee staff. The basic purpose of the statute, or the intent of our proposal, obviously, is to allow some level of protection from lawsuits arising out of the airing of political advertisements. We've seen an increase over the last few years. Thank you. An increase over the last few years in the threat and actually the filing of lawsuits. There was a lawsuit filed in 1996 by a proponent of a ballot measure against four Portland television stations, and that was disposed of in summary judgment. Basically, the court there found what just about any other court would find, which is the broadcaster themselves are not going to be held liable for the content of the political advertisement. And what we're asking for is an express statement in the statute of that legal principle, which is prior restraint. On the federal level, federal candidates that submit advertisements to broadcast stations have an absolute right, basically, to have that advertisement aired, unless, obviously, it's patently false or there's misleading content. And for that, broadcasters have immunity on the federal level for the airing of congressional political advertisements. And we're asking for a similar level of protection here. There was one other final note that I'd like to make here. The broadcasters recently did a survey of their television and radio stations and found that over 20% of radio stations and almost half of television stations either currently have a policy or are considering a policy of refusing political advertisements from state candidates or ballot measure campaigns just right off the bat, not taking the ads from the beginning. And our general position is that doesn't really serve anyone, including the broadcasters themselves, candidates, or the listening or viewing public. So a couple of questions Senator Miller had. One, we did, when we were first drafting the legislation, go to Senator Bryant, and he suggested bringing in newspapers. We drafted amendments to allow the same level of protection for publication in newspapers. Oddly enough, we took it to the Newspaper Publishers Association, and they told us that they would rather not have, not be included in the ad, that they had a different enough process, they had a little more time to review ads. And for whatever reason, and I can't speak necessarily to all of those reasons, we had -2 amendments on the House side, and those did not include the newspaper industry. We do have the cable industry, and Mike Dewey just walked in. He can tell you about their interest there. And as to the cause of action against opposing campaigns or candidates, that would still be there. The statute itself, Section 3 and 4 of the bill, basically points at the candidate or the campaign being responsible for the content of political publications or broadcast advertisements. With that, I'll close and be available for questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, the Trade Association of Oregon Cable Companies. We are supportive of House Bill 2717. Quite frankly, from time to time, our office will receive phone calls from a small cable operator primarily, and it will be late in a campaign. And whoever is providing the information, and it is fairly, if you will, misleading, accusatory, perhaps over the line, I will usually say first what appears as though they're losing if they have to start developing a campaign format along those lines. The fact of the matter is that we want to carry these ads. We do have capacity, but we do not feel comfortable with being able to figure out if every ad is factual. And the problem is, as you've seen it, late in the campaign, you will have somebody send you a letter, an attorney who will not ask you, but tell you to take it off the air. And if you don't, we're going to sue you. And we think we need a little bit of protection here so that we can continue to carry the ads that we believe should be carried. There will be some that will not be carried because they know that they crossed the line. But nonetheless, in heated campaigns, primarily on the initiative side is where we start to see this, both at the local level and at the state level. Kind of the last recourse is for somebody to say, if you don't do something, we're going to sue you, and that's why we think we need House Bill 2717.
Yes. Testimony.
Chairman Starr, I don't. I'm here as a resource in case people have questions with regard to the federal regulatory framework which governs this area of political advertising, ballot measure advertising, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that members may have.
Senator Miller.
Mr. Dewey referenced the closing hours of contentious campaigns. I'm just wondering if, given the way that some campaigns might feel about the conduct of the respective opponents, if the lawyer couldn't call the television station or the radio station to say, look, if you keep playing this, we'll have an action against you. If we exempt from all responsibility the television station or the radio station, they'll probably continue to play the ad. And maybe we'll, I'm just saying that the other candidate probably won't be too responsive to that threat. And so whatever damage is being done will continue to be done, and the party playing the ad that may later turn out to be proven false will just say, gosh, we didn't really have the appropriate time to figure out whether it's true or false, and we needed to continue to air it. And so I'm just wondering whether or not we create a situation where we perpetuate these campaigns to just spoke of the in light.
Mr. Chairman, if also Mr. Egan would like to answer the question, I think it's a good question, Mr. Miller. I kind of look at it this way, that first of all, I think the cable operator is going to ask, tell us, first of all, why the ad is incorrect, why it should be taken off. And if that person can provide the information, I would suggest that they're going to take it off. But if they can't, and it's used just literally for political purposes, they should be able to say, well, you can say that you can sue me, but go ahead and do it, you're not going to prevail. And I think by virtue of saying that, the kinds of stuff that has happened in the past will not happen as much.
If I might, in the cases where you've been sued, are you able to recover your costs? Or have you asked to recover your
Chair
costs?
Chair Senator Miller, the statute does allow for recovery of attorney fees. And I don't know if it actually occurred in the 1996 case, but one of the things you see here is that really the person or the party that's going to be on the hook or is a ballot measure campaign or a candidate's campaign PAC, and there may not be funds there to have recovered. And the issue also for broadcasters is partially lost time and just the threat of having a lawsuit out there. And so that is possible under the statute to recover attorney fees. Whether that would actually happen or not, I'm not sure.
One other question, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Other question.
I know you've got time constraints. Are there other states that have this statutory protection for broadcasters?
Mm-hmm. Chairman Starr and Senator Miller.
Introduce yourself for the
My name is Dominic Monahan. I'm General Counsel of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I am not aware of other states that have this form of protection, but I'm not aware that they also have the Oregon Corrupt Practices Act, which provides for this kind of liability, which is construed in the minds of the public, of creating a right of action against the publisher as opposed to the person who causes the publication to be made. And where the problem arose in the 1996 suit with the Portland television stations is that the initial complaint filed against the television stations was based on the construction by the plaintiff that a person who causes the publication of the false ad includes the conduit or includes the messenger of the paper. Now, the court in that case did rule that no, that is not the proper construction to give to the statute. But unfortunately, the court's ruling has little or no precedential value because it's not a published opinion. And the concern was if another proponent or opponent in a ballot measure in future election comes across that provision in the Oregon Corrupt Practices Act, they'll view it, too, as another reason to sue. And I think what the broadcaster wishes to do is to relieve himself of the grief and the money that goes into defending what, if it gets to a court, will determine to be a baseless suit. But there's no warning, there's no indication that that's the case. I might add what I thought was a relevant fact is that the Portland stations collectively spent close to $40,000 defending the suit. And it's a suit which was initiated very closely to the time of the election, and just the preparation of it, the involvement in trying to defend the suit, puts great demands on a station and a station staff just to be prepared to come to court and attend a trial on that matter. I felt that it was a lot of grief, a lot of inconvenience. They simply didn't have a proper legal foundation, and we thought that the evils of that could be corrected by clarifying in this statute that the media or the messenger should not be subject to someone else's liability for carrying someone else's message, particularly where it involves a political context.
I might, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions?
I would hear you then, perhaps, in a parallel situation, to say that if candidate X sent through the mail an outrageous statement about their opponent, clearly false, defamatory, that you don't believe the appropriate action would be to sue the Postmaster General.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Starr, Senator Miller, I think that's probably an apt assimilation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing in the work session on 2717.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller.
I move House Bill 2717 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
House Bill 2717 then moved to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? First, call the roll.
Senator Meyer.
Aye.
Senator Meyer.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2717 moved to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Carrier, Senator Miller.
Thank you.
Going to open a work session on employment. Open a work session on executive appointments, and we have for appointments to TriMet Board, Case Step. Kay, would you come forward and tell us why you want to serve on the TriMet board?
All right. I was told that I should come prepared with a couple of minutes of my background leading to some information on why I would like to be on the TriMet board. I've been a resident of Southwest Portland for about 28 years. I have a consulting business where I work with senior executives and boards of directors. In addition, I'm on a number of boards, including I'm chairman of the board of Bardenberger Incorporated. Prior to this career, I was president and chief operating officer of Portland General Electric. So I've had the opportunity to be involved in the community in many ways and in many organizations over the past several decades. One of those community involvements was serving on the Portland Development Commission for a couple of terms. And during that time, I had the opportunity to learn just how critical transportation issues are to the livability of our communities and the ability of our communities to develop and grow. And so when the governor approached me with this opportunity, it seemed a way that I could make a good contribution, and I'm excited with the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Oh. Are you a graduate of American Leadership Forum?
I am. I was in class 2.
I was in class. I think Greg Cushman was in.
Oh, yes, Greg was, Greg and I finished the last 5-mile run together. I remember that.
But his daughter is my office.
Oh, is that right?
So this is all highly important to what we're doing.
Yeah, very relevant, I think.
You want to include this in your notes.
That's right.
In fact, I think Mr. Miller knows Mr. Cushman, too.
I also know Mr. Bullard.
I know Mr. Bullard also.
Mm.
Yes.
Any further questions? Anyone else care to testify on this appointment? If not, we would...
Hands up, apparently.
Entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we recommend to the Senate that that be appointed.
Senator Bryant's moved that we recommend the Senate that they approve the appointment of Kay Stepp to the TriMet board. Any further discussion? Not. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator
Byers.
Aye.
Senator Miller. Aye. Aye. I receive the necessary majority. Recommendation is moved forward to the Senate.
Please.
I'd be happy to carry you.
Thank you, and we'll have Senator Bryant carry. And next order of business is appointment of Rosemary Davis to the Environmental Quality Commission. Rosemary has previously appeared before us. We have two witnesses on this appointment, three witnesses. We've got Paul Kyle, Steve Bridges, and who else?
We're going to go in order with seated. Okay, Mr. Chairman?
Okay, that's great.
What are we seated?
Chair number one.
For the record, I'm Dee Bridges here representing today Oregon Water Resources Congress. Our Executive Director, Jan Lee, is out of the area today, so I'm pinch-hitting for her. You are receiving a copy of our testimony, and I want to first say that we are unable to support the candidate. Jan Lee, our Executive Director, interviewed Ms. Davis in February this year, along with Mr. Terry Witt of Oregon Institute of Food and Shelter. And in that interview, Mr. Lee's questions to Ms. Davis reviewed some publications that Ms. Davis helped prepare in recent years, including the Southwest Oregon Salmon Restoration Initiative. Statements in the publication are of concern to the natural resources industries. For example, the report cites that water quality parameters throughout the basin are significantly degraded in historic conditions. The increase is primarily attributed to change in stream structure, to wider, more shallow channels, the loss of riparian habitat and shade, and the loss of watershed subsurface aquifer storage capacity fostered by forest harvest practices. When asked exactly what forest harvest practices account for the loss of habitat, specific answers were not provided. The report further advises recommendations to remove artificial barriers or minimize their impact on fish passage at Elk Creek, Savage Rapids, Antelope Creek, Bear Creek, Little Butte, and the north and south forks of Little Butte, and when asked how irrigation diversions should continue as an economic use in the basin if these diversions were removed, there was not a satisfactory answer. Report further cited reduce or eliminate or recommended to reduce or eliminate cities and irrigation districts' withdrawals of water from stream with low flows. This is not a practical option to maintain economic viability in the southwest region. The report also suggested non-renewal of aggregate site permits located in or along streams, reduction of herbicide use, close water to removal fill actions, and other suggestions included in requirements for more aggressive actions regarding non-point water drainage control. For example, maintenance of in-stream flows at level to support coho spawning, decreased irrigation return flows, establish in-stream water rights. And while these may be laudable long-term goals, if they are to be met at considerable reduction in local economic activities, the impact will be very significant on this region. In addition to the interview that I referred to earlier, many of the local residents in the region interviews with them did not result in a positive affirmation for a nomination for the EQC. The final point that I wanted to talk about was the relationship of this appointment to ballot measure 66. They are hearing the what we refer to as the SR2 committee. It has been hearing all session long ballot measure 32 or House Bill 3225, which will implement ballot measure 66. The current negotiations on that with the governor's office state that this commission that will oversee this ballot measure 66 funds, these funds and efforts include one member each from the five natural resource agencies, one of which is the EQC. Since the governor's office will not support a second confirmation for this new position, for those new positions, then we must assume that any one of the members of each of these committees might be appointed to this very important salmon, we'll call it a salmon commission for want of a better word right now. And therefore, we have to be more vigilant than in the past as to the appointment of to each of these commissions. And unfortunately, this is the first one that has come up since the negotiations with the governor's office. And for that reason, we cannot support that reason and the others I enumerated. We cannot support this candidate.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Barr?
I don't know the other members of the EQC. I assume we're looking for balance here. Do you, I assume your objections are, do you believe that Mr. Davis is a little tilted towards the green side?
Chairman Starr, Senator Beyer, some may say that.
And do you believe that the balance on the commission now is too oriented one way or the other?
Or the EQC?
The EQC, sir.
Have no particular concern one way or the other on that. I don't honestly follow that commission very closely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paulette Pyle, Director of Grassroots for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. As Dee stated, Terry Whip, my business partner, is the one that interviewed Rosemary. However, he asked me to do follow-up phone calls into the area to see if we could solicit. In fact, we didn't just do follow-up phone calls. We sent out a memo to our members asking them to send information back to us as to their desires on this appointment. And we did not receive any positive support back. It was all negative. And it was basically the folks that had worked with her were very complimentary of her as a person. They liked her. But in her workings in the community on the environmental issues, many of them stated we all have our biases in life, and her biases they did not feel would be objective as to them with their work as natural resource folks. And so they really wanted to be cautious and wanted us to oppose her. Her comments on the reduction of herbicide use concerned us, of course. And then just her general overall philosophy. It is our practice at Oregonians for Food and Shelter, as it is with the other natural resources communities, when these appointments come up, we call ourselves together in a room and we look at them, we hope, in an objective way. We try to interview them personally, and then we, of course, send our memos out to our membership, check downline, and get input back from the ground. And that's how we make our decisions here. And so OFS is going to oppose this appointment also. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Well, in your calling into the district and discussion, you said that a lot of people expressed that they liked her personally, but were concerned about her positions. Did they find, or did you get into conversation in terms of, was she a good group member in terms of discussing and exploring issues?
I would guess that was the feedback I got. I didn't get any negative in that respect at all. Their concern was when the decisions needed to be made about a particular practice or management of an area, they didn't feel like they were taken duly into consideration. Depending on their economic needs, she was more in tune to the environmental needs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And not to be too repetitive, but much along the same lines as far as the draft, something that we very definitely would be objecting to would be limiting of access of livestock from the riparian zones and fencing the streams, fencing livestock away from the stream.
Thank you. Everybody opposed that?
Mr. Chairman, I might add for the publication that Deep passed out the comments that we are referring to are in the back by page, so you can review what our concerns are that way based on the input she had on the publication. Thank you.
Senator Beyer,
one more, if I could.
Oh, that's time.
I'll answer or not. I'm not very familiar with the EQC in terms of their balance or whether you're looking or not. I'm curious because I know you watch it closer than I do.
Right.
Do you consider it tilted one way or the other too much now?
Senator Starr, Representative Beyer. Senator Beyer, get there.
Been around too long.
I would say there's been some major improvements in the last few years as far as our membership goes, and I'm not avoiding your question. It's much more balanced now than it was. We're still striving to ensure that we keep that balance. And so I'm not getting a major number of complaints about the ECC today as we did in the past. So, and I do watch them somewhat. I think we're doing okay. We just want to ensure that we continue to do that.
Year before last, when the before the 401 certification for those grazing cattle on federal lands had, there was a court case, federal court case, that would require the state to step in and either waive the certification or require certification of cattle producers who graze on federal land. As we presented our case to the commission, it was obvious that it was slanted against us and virtually made a tremendous burden on the on those cattle producers that graze federal lands. Now, fortunately, the appellate court reversed the original decision, and we no longer have to do that. But it was an opportunity to say, this is redundant, it's going to be very costly to producers, and virtually we can see no value to it as we presented our case. And in every case where the cattle producers did submit their very costly and lengthy plans, every one of them was approved, which in some respects say, well, thank you, but by other respects it says, you agree that the process they've already gone through with the federal government has completely satisfied the water quality issue. So in that respect, maybe that's a slight answer to your question, Senator Barr.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stonebrink made me think of this when he talked about livestock in Measure 38, I believe it was, like most people in this state appropriately concluded that was a very extreme measure and rejected it, just as they did Measure 64, extraordinarily extreme, and a very solid rejection. Do you know if Ms. Davis had an opinion, a position on either of those two measures? Did that ever come up in any discussion you had with her? Do you recall whether she was in support or...
Senator Carson, Jamila, she was asked that question, and I happened to get in on the tail end of the interview, and I don't remember the answer. Most of her answers that I heard were very evasive and inconclusive. I mean, she just didn't go there when we talked to her, and Senator Starr wasn't part of that interview. We didn't come out satisfied that we had enough information, actually, as far as our industry was concerned, to be able to support her, but I don't remember that answer, but we did ask.
If I may, Senator Miller, the report that we're referring to did indicate that she was in favor of fencing the riparian areas. And I just wanted to add to my earlier comments about that. Not that cattlemen are want to be poor stewards or bad for the environment, because we think we are good stewards. But the jury is still out. And in numerous cases, I can show you where cattlemen who thought they were doing the environmentally friendly thing did fence their streams voluntarily, and only to find out that it actually caused tremendous harm to the environment, where woody, too much brush and too much other debris collected, and actually had tremendous blowouts into the pasture land because of that fencing instead of having managed grazing. And another case where it built up a tremendous fuel load and lightning struck a snag, and then it virtually burned up everything in the riparian area. So I think the jury's still out on what should be done in those areas rather than just say, gee, it would be great for the environment if we just fence the streams. And that's what it looks like for indications where she would prefer to fence the streams.
Thank you very much. Chair is going to continue this nomination for the time. And we will open close the work session on Rosemary Davis and open the work session on Louise Scatlin to the State Marine Board. Louise.
Chair, Senator Starr, and members of the committee, my name is Louise Gatlin,
And I have, presently I'm retired. I worked as a, for the Portland Public Schools as a library assistant in Portland. And now I'm currently serving with the Coast Guard Auxiliary volunteer as the Vice Commodore of the 13th District. With my auxiliary qualifications, which most of my boating experiences come to me from the auxiliary, I am qualified as a master instructor and vessel examiner to check vessels for safety equipment. And
what
also a crew. Pardon?
Excuse me, what is the 13th District?
Oh, I'm sorry. 13th Coast Guard District. 13th Coast Guard District is Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. And that's what we're responsible for.
Thank you.
My favorite activity is teaching water safety classes to children and doing vessel examinations on recreational boats. The boating classes, safety exams on boats, I feel gives me the greatest opportunity to reach the boaters on safety and law enforcement issues. At this time, I'm working on a program that will reach the people that do not think that they are boaters, such as fish and personal watercraft, the fish people that fish and personal watercraft and boats under 18 feet. My boating experience has been a boat owner with my husband for 20-plus years, and we generally boat mostly on the Columbia River. The past 11 years, we spent most of our time doing safety patrols for the Coast Guard Auxiliary on the Columbia River. I know with this position on the State Marine Board that the Marine Board represents a broader group of water users than just the recreational boaters, such as woo mortgage owners and floating homeowners. I have not had the experience with the floating homeowners or woo. I did sit on a committee of the Multnomah County Sheriff Neighborhood Association, and I was not able to attend as many meetings as I would have liked to as I was working at the time. I feel that I can look at other avenues of water users besides the recreational boaters with information supplied to me. If I have the privilege of being selected for this position on the Marine Board, I'd be willing to contribute my experience and knowledge that I have gained through the auxiliary and boating on the rivers, and make a contribution to the state of Oregon for the betterment of safety and education and law enforcement where needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Anyone else care to testify? If not, I would entertain a motion to
Chairman.
Oh, go ahead, Senator Barr.
I do have some questions. I received a letter, and I was curious if someone can answer, and I don't know, maybe Brian can, in terms of who is currently on the board and the number of folks in the metropolitan area and whether that's representative of our members.
Members of the committee, there are 5 members on the committee, and 2 of those members, one of those members is from the Oregon City area, and Ms. Gatlin would obviously be from the Portland area. The other members are from Gold Beach, Coquille, and Bend.
My desire to move this nomination
forward. I just wanted to see if Mary Brown
is finished.
I guess I don't have a clue what the percentage number of boats are in the metropolitan area. I assume it's a huge percentage of the boats in the state of Oregon, but I don't know that anybody would know the answer to that.
Paul Don Heffner would know. He knows all that stuff. I believe it's 52.3.
Oh. Or you have them in your neighborhood.
Just a big one.
Just a big one.
That's a big one.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to recommend the appointment of Louise Gatlin to the Oregon State Marine Board.
Senator Miller has moved to recommend the appointment of, I don't have the name for me here, Louise Gatlin to the State Marine Board. Any further discussion? Not clerk, call the roll.
Aye. Senator
Brown.
Aye.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator
Miller.
Aye.
Senator
Stubbs. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the appointment is moved to the floor for consideration.
Thank you.
That, I'm closing the carrier for appointment.
Senator Bryant, who Senator would carry the first one for us to do these two.
I would be happy to. All right, we will do that. And I'm going to open the public hearing on Bill 1245. And we've got a whole bunch of folks signed up here in order. And
geez, that's a lot of interest.
It's the first hearing for this bill.
Is this somebody's priority bill?
This is somebody's priority bill. No, this gentleman's priority bill.
Is it a senator's priority?
Yeah,
Perioli.
Is it a priority bill?
No, it's not a priority in the sense that it was a bill drafted from a priority bill. In fact, it's a group of bills. I am looking over our list here. No one's traveled more than 100 miles. Our amendments have come forward. They're incorrect. I'm going to suggest that we set this over. I'm sorry about that. We could take testimony. But I think that we would not do real service to anyone not having the amendments drafted as were desired. And so, would be.
Yes. Chair, I mean, I'm very happy to sit here and listen to public testimony. The reason why I ask the questions is that I think the bill deadline hearing date for Senate committee bills was May 12th.
There is some...
2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And in fact, I think the deadline for hearing is coming up soon. Anyway, so if we're going to hear this bill, my suggestion is we do it.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. I will hand the gavel to my vice chair. Let him take some testimony on this bill. And I am... I'm going to take care of a previous engagement here, and I'm sorry to absent myself at such a time, but Vice Chair, turn the meeting over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1245. And we have a Senator Sheets.
We do have here somewhere. Okay. I just followed it.
Right here it is. I would now point out that given that there are some amendments we know that have not been drafted appropriately or correctly, that this will be rescheduled. And so we probably invite the witnesses to be brief, and but we will hold a hearing.
We've even given up.
Oh, here we go.
Public hearings on the
very soon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. simple bill, simple fix, not quite as easy as all that. What we're trying to do simply is allow for agencies to notify property owners before entry on the private property. And it's a simple issue. However, it gets very complex when you're trying to deal with agencies that have regulatory powers that are protecting public health, wealth, and welfare and safety. We did try to draft some amendments, and I suggested some suggestions to the Legislative Council. They didn't come out the way we expected them to. What the issue now is, we used Senate Bill 1245, which was dealing with the Water Resources Commission, and then inserted each one of the agencies as a dash 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. Each one of those deals with a separate agency, but it's the language that's similar, saying please give verbal notice. And defines what verbal notice is and defines what personal notice, and that could be either verbal or 3 days written first class notice. What has transpired when we've been reviewing the amendments is that there are some statutory problems with some of the agency's regulatory powers. That is not what we were intending. We were not intending to mess with the agency's regulatory powers, but merely to help them along in how they conducted their business. And I apologize, we didn't get the amendments the way we needed them to. Had this bill come out late in the session, we had worked with Senator Farioli on this issue. It took a long time to get out of Legislative Council for some reason, and by the time they dropped, we had to move them out of Senate Water Policy Committee. That's where they were. We moved them over here with the concurrence of the chair and the chair, Senator Starr, because we needed more time to work the bills. Evidently, we didn't have even enough time to work them correctly. We did have a meeting scheduled on one of the bills, Senate Bill 1235, that dealt with DEQ. In the hallway, as you probably know, there's a lot of conversations that go on before the bill actually gets to the committee. The bill was scheduled, but it never actually got into the committee hearing. But we have taken a lot of discussion, a lot of the concerns from DEQ, and tried to draft those comments and then submit it to LC to see if we can answer those concerns. Frankly, I don't think they were answered. I think the concerns are still there. So I want to try and answer those concerns, and that's why we're here. And I want to listen to each of the agencies to find out what concerns that they have and make sure that I try to address those issues in the redraft. And we're frankly running out of time, but I'm trying my best to get this thing out because I think it's good for the agencies as well as private property owners. So thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Other questions? Mr. Chair, just one comment.
Everybody.
First class mail and the number of infections and things that happen, unless you narrow the bill considerably, that's going to be an expense. It would go down to Ways and Means, and it would probably die there. So you've got to figure out a way to avoid too much of an expense, and that also gets into the issue of trying to prepare the letter. I was just talking about the cost of a stamp. The Department of Ag advises me they can have about 65,000 infections a year, and I know you're not trying to capture all those infections, but even if it were 2,000, there's a cost involved there.
Sir Bryant, Mr. Chair, yes, and I was trying to limit that, Senator Bryant, and in most cases, for instance, the personal notice will cover most of those issues because the fact that you will come to a property. Most of the time, but at least I know, the water masters don't enter private property without some type of permission. So that would be covered under personal notice. They wouldn't have to mail it. The only time they'd mail it is if nobody was available. I share your concerns. I want to look at that and make sure that we haven't set some type of broad requirement here that's going to encompass a fiscal impact, and that certainly wasn't intended. So let me look at that and make sure that that's addressed. I'm sorry.
Well, one of these amendments, it does
state that personal notice means verbal notice to the landowner or occupant if sent 3 days prior to entry.
Mr. Chair,
I suppose you could waive that if you called them the day of and they agreed.
The intent of the notice in defining personal notice would mean verbal notice, and that would mean either calling, knocking on the door. If you called, knocked on the door, nobody there, nobody would answer, then the other option was the mail notice, because you couldn't locate anybody. And so that was the intent, was to try and give you the option. And I'm trying to answer Senator Bryan's concern that he doesn't want to mail out the 48,000 inspection notices. I agree, and I want to make sure we've addressed that. I'm assuming, for instance, on many of these inspections, things, that's not what I'm aiming at. I'm aiming at a broader range, trying to narrow these agencies' powers ever so smallly, but just to add the notice provision.
You're just suggesting before the government intrudes on private property, perhaps they ought to be required to give notice to the owner.
Correct, Senator.
Thank you. Okay. Well, we've got a whole long list of people who want to tell us why that's not reasonable. All right. D. Bridges.
For the record, I'm Dee Bridges, representing Oregon Water Resources Congress. Again, I'm here pinch hitting for Jan Lee, who is out of the area. Much of our testimony was written with regard to the original bill. Hadn't seen the amendments at that point, so I'm going to just veer from the written testimony there and kind of generalize as to what our concern is. Our concern is primarily with water masters. We need to have our water masters be able to regulate against the illegal use of water, illegal diversions, or in overuse of a junior water right holder's water right, in order to protect our senior users. We, frankly, are comfortable with the laws as they presently exist with regard to how the water masters handle that. And are skeptical of any change required that would be required by this bill or any amended version of it. So with that, really, that's all I have to say.
Questions? Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what is the current practice?
To tell you the truth, I'm not an expert on that. As I understand it, the current practice is that they do try to contact the landowner, if they do not get a response from somebody at home, they will enter onto the property if it's open area and if they think there's a good reason for them to go there. But again, I'm not the person to ask that, for the department is.
So I guess, Mr. Chair, my other question would be, and you may not be the answer. So, is there other ways to detect people who are breaking the law in terms of water other than actually going on the property and assessing the water use?
Again, I don't know that. I think that's we leave that up to the water masters.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Bill Ward, Paul Cleary, Mike Dewey.
Chair, if I might, I'd like to invite Richard Whitman from the Attorney General's office.
That would be just fine.
Maybe lead off for the state agency.
Tell Mr. Dewey to hang up.
Okay.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Whitman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. We've provided written testimony on SB 1245 today. The purpose of the written testimony and the testimony I'm going to give you verbally, and I am going to give you the shortened version,
The purpose of that is twofold. First of all, to provide some overview of the existing law with regard to the authority and limitations on state agencies regarding entry on the private property. And second of all, to provide an overview of what we believe the effects of Senate Bill 1245 would be on the ability of state agencies to enter private property. First of all, in terms of what the existing law is, a couple things. It's first important to understand that state agencies have no inherent authority to go onto private property. They can only go onto private property if the legislature or the voters have authorized them to. And there are a number of statutes that do authorize a variety of programs and to go onto private property where it's necessary to carry out other statutory duties that state agencies have. As a general rule, even where they have statutory authorities, state agencies under both the federal and the state constitution can't go on to private property unless they either have a warrant, an administrative warrant, or have consent from the property owner. In many circumstances with agencies we're dealing with, in this particular bill, there is consent via a license or a permit that has been granted by the agency, and there's either a requirement in statute or a requirement in rule that the permittee or licensee allow the agency onto the property to assure that they're operating in conformance with that permit or license. There are several exceptions to the requirement that you either have a warrant or have consent, and the first deals with emergency circumstances where it's necessary to go on private property to deal with a threat to public health or safety. Or there's another doctrine also called exigent circumstances where it's necessary to go on private property in order to preserve evidence of a violation of law. The second general area of exception is with regard to vacant land, land away from homes, and land that is not fenced and land that is not posted, no trespassing. As a general matter, state agencies that have the authority to go onto that open land may do so without a warrant or without consent. Finally, with regard to some regulatory programs where the legislature has set criteria for when the agency may go onto private property and limited the purposes that they may go onto the property for, entry without a warrant or consent can be allowed. But wherever you start to pick at those exceptions, you find out a couple of things. One, that it's much more complicated than I just told you. There are a lot of qualifications to the exceptions. And in addition, as a general matter, the courts construe those exceptions extremely narrowly. They generally construe them against the authority to enter property. So with that general background, let me go quickly through what we believe Senate Bill 1245 would do as a general matter, and then I'll turn it over to the representatives from the state agencies to talk a little bit particularly about their programs. First of all, as stated by Mr. Schmidt, the bill generally requires that these particular state agencies provide personal notice prior to entry onto property. And personal notice can be provided either verbally, if there's somebody present on the property, an occupant or an owner. And one problem with the law in this area is defining who the owner is or who the occupant is. Or if nobody's present on the property, as is going to be true with many of these programs, then notice can be provided by first-class mail sent 3 days prior to entry. One thing that's important to make clear is that simply by providing notice, it does not mean that entry onto the property is going to be lawful. There still has to be consent or a warrant under the Constitution. So this is essentially adding a requirement on top of the protections that are there under the state and federal constitutions already. In terms of effects of the bill, there are four broad effects. First of all, as I noted at the outset, this is going to affect a lot of people who have permits or licenses from state agencies and who have either in the statutes or rules authorizing those permits or in the permits themselves terms that authorize entry on the land for the purpose of determining whether the activity is being carried out properly. This bill, as drafted, would still require prior either verbal notice or, if nobody's present, would require written notice 3 days prior to entry, even where the property owner has previously consented to entry onto the land. Second effect, where a state agency has a warrant to go on the property, this bill still would require prior notice to the property owner, again, either verbally or 3 days prior in writing. Third, one of the exceptions, and it's an important exception that I noted earlier, is the authority to go on the property where there are emergencies such as flooding, such as fires, threats to public health or safety. This bill would require prior notice, and again, if nobody is present to receive verbal notice, it would require written notice. It effectively imposes a statutory waiting period, at least for open land, and eliminates the ability of state agencies to go on the property in emergencies, at least where there's no one present. And finally, one thing that's sort of buried in the bill right now is that the amendments to the various statutes delete current authority of agencies to go on to public lands for purposes of inspection. Normally you wouldn't think that's a problem, but there are many types of public property that are not generally open to the public. I'll give you a few examples. Wastewater treatment facilities that are operated by municipalities, airports, incinerators, landfills, those are some of those types of property. This bill, by deleting the authority of these agencies to go on the public lands, would make it, could seriously interfere with their statutory duties that are affected by these particular amendments. I think I'm going to leave it at that, and that's sort of a broad overview. There are some particular problems pertinent to some of the individual agencies. One thing I will just note concerns the Department of Environmental Quality. The bill language dealing with the Department of Environmental Quality is a little bit different than what I've described if it affects the other agencies. It requires personal notice unless there's probable cause to believe a violation of laws occurring, and I'm paraphrasing here, or that there's contamination present on the property. I think that language was drafted in an attempt to meet some of the concerns of DEQ, but again, it doesn't get there for a couple of reasons. First of all, DEQ, where it sets up routine inspection programs for highly regulated businesses or ultra-hazardous activities, would be required still to provide advance written notice where there's nobody present on the property. Again, if the agency has a warrant, and there are some circumstances where the agency can have a warrant but not have probable cause, they would have to go through the waiting period. And finally, just generally, the limitations that the bill currently imposes on DEQ, we believe, could result in a loss of federal delegation of some of the pollution control programs that are delegated by the Environmental Protection Agency. Those would include, in particular, Clean Water Act water quality area, but also air quality and other areas as well. Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you. Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Ward with the Department of Agriculture. I just would, I won't belabor the issues that Mr. Whitman has raised. I just would say that we do have, because of these issues, we do have a concern with this bill, with these bills, simply due to the fact that we do about 65,000 inspections or private property entries every year. And we've done that for many, many years. It's these inspections are the bedrock of our statutory authority and responsibility in the state of Oregon. And they're there for a couple reasons. One, these programs are there at the request of the industry to serve industry needs, brand inspection program, nursery inspection program, those kind of things, or they're there to protect public health and safety. And so we would have a concern relative to any legislation that could potentially cause our ability to operate these inspections in an efficient, cost-effective manner. And I think we have a long history in conducting inspections with on private property successfully. Here in Oregon, I would be surprised if any of you here today had ever received a complaint from a constituent about our inspection procedures. We believe strongly in the sanctity of private property and attempt to honor folks in that regard very carefully. But because of a number of the questions that you've heard articulated already relative to this legislation, we're deeply concerned about its potential impact on our program. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Clary, Director of the Division of State Lands. Provided you with written testimony, would just note that our practice is to always try to contact landowners and permit applicants before going on to land. We have to work with these folks. We find that if we get off on the right foot, they're much more cooperative in helping us resolve any problems that are occurring. And so our interest is starting off on that right foot. However, there are some instances and there are emergencies where we do need to go on the property where we're not able to schedule an advance appointment. And quite often it's in a situation such as a major flood event or where we've got problems that are being caused to up or downstream landowners. And those are the times when we need the ability to enter onto that property and try to resolve that problem in a timely manner. And we're concerned that 1245 would limit our ability to respond in those emergencies. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes.
You can go ahead. You want?
Yes. Thank you. For the record, Martha Tagle, Director of the Water Resources Department. I also have written testimony, and so I'll rely on that for your record and just give you a quick summary of our concerns. Basically, we too think that we have a pretty good track record in working with property owners, and our existing statutes, rules, and the case law that Mr. Whitman described for you pretty much put us to an operating structure where if we don't have permission to enter the property from the person who has control of the property, then we have to go and get an administrative warrant or otherwise find a way to investigate that doesn't require entering onto the property. And I'm also able to report that in the 7 years that I've been the director, I haven't received a complaint from a property owner about the methods by which we attempted to work with the property owner to enter the property. I'm not aware of complaints that have been filed with you or your colleagues. So I think generally we have a system that works. Some of the problems that we can see with the bill and even as it's intended, the idea of providing written notice to the owner of the property sounds good, but with respect to water rights in this state, we have thousands of water rights that require active management by our water masters, so we don't necessarily know who the property owner is. The water right doesn't tell us. It gives us a legal description of where the water can be used, and in many cases, the water right was issued 50 years ago, and we don't know who the current owner is. So we'd have a big administrative burden and a big fiscal impact just trying to figure out who the owner is in order to send out such a notice, notwithstanding what you've already heard about the time limitations that that would put upon us. The other major concern that we have about the proposed amendments to 1245 with respect to our groundwater program, this would not only affect the method of notice, but it would also affect the type of inspection that we can conduct. So it makes a substantive change and would limit our inspection to the actual time of construction or alteration of a well. That, again, would be a huge fiscal impact in having enough inspectors to be able to be out there when that work is occurring, and it would also substantially change our program. So we have concerns about that.
Thank you very much. All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Langdon Marsh, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And Mr. Whitman has done an excellent job of outlining the concerns, so I'll be brief. I have some written testimony. I also just wanted to affirm that DEQ very strongly respects private property rights. Ordinarily, we do seek permission and obtain permission either by a phone call or by showing up at the door. So, in fact, we are, by practice, limited to the kinds of things that the bill seeks to do. We perform about 2,700 inspections a year, so it would be there would be some significant burden in terms of paperwork and other actions that would be required to implement this bill. The major concerns are four. One, the ability to respond quickly to emergencies. If we have to give the three-day notice, that might not be possible. Secondly, the federal delegation problem that is a real concern to us because we work very hard to maintain delegation of our federal programs, and they do require equivalence of state procedures and processes, including inspections. And finally, the question of entry onto public property is a very important thing for us to be able to go to a municipal sewage treatment plant or a landfill or incinerator or other public facility and be able to inspect that with this bill would appear to preclude us from doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, if I may just go back to, I realized in giving my testimony, I said if we don't have permission, we knock on the door if we don't have permission, that we're basically limited to then getting an administrative warrant. That's in situations where we suspect illegal use or we're doing compliance inspections. And the one thing I wanted to clarify is that our water masters also have to make frequent visits to property for what we call distribution, which is not an illegal use, but rather to tell a junior user. And this gets to the question that Senator Brown raised earlier. Tell the junior water right holder that they have to turn off in order to serve the senior. In those situations, because they have a permit, a water right permit, we understand that there's an implied permission. If they are not there to answer the door, we leave a note and we post a notice on the head gate. So in that would be the only instance where we would enter the open areas of the property to post the head gate without permission.
Thank you again. Mr. Chair, also on the water end of it, it's been in representing irrigation districts, we've always taken the position that if you're walking down the ditch road and along the canal, and that you have a right to be there because it is created either by statute or through adverse possession as an easement, not only for the delivery of the water, but to maintain it and check the head gates and monitor the flowage.
Mr. Dewey, Mr. Ashton, hanging out there behind the...
He's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, Oregon Recreators League, we applaud the goal of the proponents of this bill in terms of protecting private property rights. Obviously, we are there with regard to that statement. When we first heard about the bill, I asked our members if they had any concerns about inspections, and we had not heard of any concerns, so this was not a high-priority bill. In talking to the Department of Agriculture about the potential costs, and Senator Bryant brought that up, we're attempting to enhance the programs, and with the cost that could be attributed to the amendments. Obviously, we would start looking at basically decreasing the size of some programs that we would like to enhance. And so we have that conundrum, and we just think this bill has a long ways to go, particularly on the inspections that have to be made, the emergency type, weights and measures and the like. It doesn't make a lot of sense to notify somebody 3 days in advance you're going to be there at 12 o'clock so they can fix and calibrate and so forth. And waste management and things like that that we represent, we do believe that they should be able to come on your property from time to time without notice to make sure that the practices are ethical, legal, and reasonable. So we cannot support the bill in its present form, and perhaps this is a good opportunity to look at the interim for an activity of this sort. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Dewey. We're grateful for your testimony. Scott Ashton, Dave Nelson, Mr. Stonebrain.
For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The Oregon Cattlemen view these bills, or this bill, however you want to look at it, as basically a private property rights issue. And not to go into a long history, but I'm sure that you remember the Revolutionary War, and it was fought because of, primarily, of property rights, as reflected in the Bill of Rights, which had numerous of those, which I won't go into, that was there to protect the individual's private property. What I think is interesting is that what the Constitution did not say, and I think sometimes that speaks louder than what it does say, and that it did not say, well, if it's inconvenient or if it costs too much, then we will violate your constitutional rights. And yet I think oftentimes that's where we've gone with this. So the Oregon Cattlemen support, although we don't have the exact amendments, but we support the concept. And basically what we're saying is that the landowner should have the right to say no, whether he suspects or not suspects of any violation under Oregon statutes. But they should have the opportunity to say no. Under present activities, they are not given the opportunity to say no.
Questions? Thank you very much. Larry George signed up, and I don't see him. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1245? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1245. Anything further to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.
Chair?
Excuse me, Senator Brown?
I was not present when the vote occurred on House Bill 2717.
I'll make a note of your
efforts. Thank you.
Anything for her?
You already did. I would just like to register an aye vote.
Oh.
If there is not an objection.
Is there an objection?
Does not change the outcome.
Senator Brown be recorded as an aye vote on House Bill 2717.
Thank you for your extended courtesy, Mr. Chair.
Is there anything further to come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.
Yeah, we're going to go to the federal today.